Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking about militarism and climate. Our guest is Stuart Parkinson. He is executive director at Scientists for Global Responsibility, which you can find at sgr.org.uk. He is the author of numerous reports related to the connection between militarism and environmental destruction. He is the co-author of a book on the Kyoto Protocol and an editor of the Responsible Science Journal. Stuart Parkinson, welcome back to Talk World Radio.
Hi, good to be with you.
Great to see you. I think your most recent report is on the impact on the climate of military spending increases, which tragically, I think, sounds like bewildering nonsense to many listeners. Can you explain?
Yeah, so this is a particularly European, well, the focus of our report, or one of the focuses of our report, was particularly about European increases in military spending that are underway at the moment. Particularly since the full invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and the arming by NATO of Ukraine in response to that. And so we've seen a large increase in military budgets across Europe over the last few years, and particularly and that's been supercharged by Trump's announcements statements undermining his commitment to NATO. And so that's led to governments on this side of the Atlantic arguing for much larger spending increases, and various funding mechanisms have been made available either through government spending mechanisms or through EU spending mechanisms. And so this is leading to a large rise in military spending. We've already seen military spending in Europe increase from about 1.5% GDP to nearly 2% GDP, and there's a push for it to go up to possibly 3%, 3.5%. The NATO summit next week may come up with a more definitive agreement, or it may not. We will see. Those spending increases are leading to, obviously, buying more weapons, more military activity. And the way in which that leads to greenhouse gas emissions is that militaries are very high fossil fuel users. They burn lots of fuel in their activity. And then they are supplied by companies which use lots of fossil fuel energy in producing new weapons and all the other supplies that militaries need.
I know that NATO wants everyone to talk about percentage of GDP, but of course this means actual huge increases in absolute pounds and euros and per capita, which I think are saner means of measuring the size of military spending.
Yeah, I mean, we've looked at in a report that I co-wrote with some colleagues from the Conflict and Environment Observatory and Initiative on Greenhouse Gas Accounting of War, and a couple of other organisations. We looked at what might be the increases in emissions across the whole economy from increasing military spending. And these are of the order of around 140 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent if spending in Europe increases to about 3.5% of GDP. So what that means, what 140 million tons of GHGs is something like a medium-sized European country added to the global total, so sort of above the Netherlands, above Poland, that sort of level. If military spending goes higher, then emissions will correspondingly go higher. Yeah. I mean, there was another study published in Nature recently, which concluded that for every 0.1% GDP increase in military spending at a global level, you would get about 400 million tons extra added to the global total of emissions. And that's equivalent to a country like Britain or France or even Germany. So it's a huge amount of emissions being added to the global total. And yeah, this is, I mean, that spending across that would be spending across the world, but of course we are seeing it's not just concentrated in Europe. We're seeing spending increases in North America. We're seeing spending increases obviously in Russia and China and the Middle East. It's particularly bad at the moment. So yeah, those spending increases are happening.
Which parts of militarism are the worst for climate, and what difference does it make that they put solar panels on a few generals' offices and so forth?
So the most visible form of emissions is in things like aircraft and warships. So those are particularly high. If you look at direct emissions from military activities, it's always the aircraft that are the biggest component of that. And what's worse is that aircraft, when they're flying in the upper atmosphere, the emissions are multiplied by indirect effects, and so that's doubles the warming at least. Some studies argue that it trebles the warming that happens through those emissions. So yeah, and then there's warships as well. Obviously, huge energy consumption of warships, and then on ground vehicles, tanks, etc. Armored vehicles. But then there's also long supply chains. So you have all the manufacturing of this equipment, you have all the fuel supplies, you have transportation. Moving things around is very costly. A lot of that happens through civilian networks, so it's not directly accounted for through military networks. When private security companies are hired by militaries, that is another contributor. And you've seen, particularly in the USA, that as the US military numbers of active personnel have shrunk, you've seen the number of contractors grow. And so, again, things are being shifted off into the supply chain. Emissions is being shifted off into the supply chain. And so it goes on, everything food supplies and shifting food supplies around the world to keep militaries fed is another component. There are so many of these. So supply chains are long and big.
If we were sort of all good environmentalist, militarist liberals, and we didn't use straws, and we put solar panels on our roof and got an electric car, and we recycled our garbage, but we were happy to put a majority of our tax dollars into things like fighter jets and so forth, what's the net impact? How do you compare, recycling your trash with a fighter jet,
Well, yeah, obviously, these are huge emissions on their own and compared with an individual household, for example. But I guess one way of looking at it is the difficulty in reducing emissions in that the military has to go to. So, for example, if you put solar panels at a military base, because they're high energy uses, you will need a lot more solar panels on that base. And you can do that, but it's more expensive and it's less effective than reducing emissions through having a smaller military or having a military that is only orientated towards, basic defensive borders rather than power projection across the world. So that's the first element. I mean, there are some discussion whether there's research programs that are starting up looking at using lower carbon technologies for military purposes, things like, can we electrify tanks? Can we put biofuels in planes? Can we put synthetic fuels in planes? Are drones running off electricity lower carbon? All these sorts of things. So they're starting to look at this sort of area. But the trouble is, military technologies are very energy intensive. If they're used in a sort of combat situation, then they're even more energy intensive. Then you've got the fact that they are very specialized, and so it's very inefficient often to make these changes. And then coupled with the fact that the types of systems are very hard to decarbonize. So, for example, in aviation, civilian planes are very hard to decarbonize. You can't just put batteries on them and make them electric because batteries are very heavy. You can't just convert them to hydrogen because hydrogen has a very high volume. So you have to make planes much bigger. That's completely redesigning the process. One hope is that, well, we use biofuels, but biofuels can be very energy intensive to produce. And if you're using crops to produce those biofuels, then you're taking land away from food production. So there are all these issues, and then you've got nuclear as well. And the argument goes, oh, well, nuclear is lower carbon, so we should use that. And but nuclear has all the issues of radioactive waste. I mean, and long life cycles, dispose that decommissioning management regimes that are needed for centuries, if not thousands of years. So there's no good options really for reducing military carbon emissions substantially,
Other than reducing militaries.
other than reducing military, yes, sorry,
And
technological ways of doing it.
militaries, of course, don't just damage the climate, they poison the land, the air, the water in numerous ways. And people have calculated, I think, some of the damage, including to the climate of particular wars, even the current war on Gaza, right? I've seen some people try to look at the impact.
Yes. So some colleagues of mine have tried to put some figures on these, and yes, it's again, the estimates are sort of in around 1 to 2 million tons of carbon dioxide just directly in the war, using the fuel used in the bombings and for the tanks, etc., but also the supply chains getting the equipment to the battlefield, resupplying ammunition, etc., particularly from the United States, and Germany, and to a lesser extent the UK. So there's that side of it, and then there's reconstruction, and reconstruction, particularly Gaza, because it's been so flattened. Reconstruction could take, decades, and those emissions of reconstructing to anything like the level of buildings that they had before the war, that's tens of millions of tons. So that multiplies the effect, and you see a similar situation in Ukraine. And in other countries, you've got this long tail of emissions where reconstruction takes place after wars, and that commits you to large emissions well beyond the direct impacts.
We are speaking with Stuart Parkinson, who is Executive Director of Scientists for Global Responsibility. You can check out sgr.org.uk. Stuart, I've seen this argument that I hope is having an impact, that these increases in military spending will lead to this increase in climate destruction, which will lead to environmental crises and migration, which will cause wars. And so you're actually creating wars rather than peace, which sort of disturbs me because the military spending directly makes wars more likely. You don't have to go through these three steps to get to wars being more likely. And it disturbs me to eliminate human agency. Humans who don't use wars to solve migration problems don't get wars. It's a choice. But I still hope that that argument is reaching people who maybe care more about war helping the slow destruction of life than they do about war so quickly eliminating so many lives and threatening to quickly cause nuclear apocalypse. What do you think of these arguments?
I think we've got to be very careful about the argument that war, that climate change causes war, because it's a dangerous argument that the militaries are using to prop up their spending and to increase their spending and say, well, climate change is going to make everything more unstable, and therefore you need militaries to keep you safe in a more unstable world. And that's a very dangerous argument because there are lots of other ways of reducing instability that might be caused by climate change. If you have food supplies impacted by climate change, having good governance, an equal society, robust distribution networks for the food, then you will be far more resilient to the impacts of climate change, and you'll be less likely to fall into a situation of instability and conflict. And that's kind of lost in this argument around war causes the climate change causes war. So it's quite a dangerous argument to use, and again, it kind of feeds into the whole military argument that we just need bigger militaries. Whatever the problem is, we just need bigger militaries, and that's really not the situation.
And peace activists repeat this argument and they think it's a good one. And yet, as you say, if we had more democracy and fewer F-35s in the name of democracy, we would have other means of addressing crises.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's also a danger with militaries being used. Well, some militaries arguing, oh, we need more disaster relief, and militaries are well placed to provide disaster relief. But you think, well, if we had civilian agencies well funded enough, then they could provide disaster relief, and that would be a lot more efficient, both in terms of resources and in terms of money, because you wouldn't have a fighting force trained with. Which has no role in disaster relief. You don't need people equipped with weapons to deal with a disaster. You simply need proper resources to help distribute supplies and build various shelters in a disaster to help people recover.
And people who were unarmed and legitimately intending to help with the disaster would leave after they finished helping. Because the armed forces, they never leave. They build bases which have an environmental cost as well. I want to ask you, because I've always wondered, I spend a lot of time looking at foreign military bases. Whose country does the environmental destruction of environmental bases get added to the data of the occupier or the host?
It does depend. Often it is the host. So the country and because the US has so many more foreign bases than any other country, where
Than all
around
the other
seven
countries put together.
the other countries are often it's the host country that will report on those emissions and then be obliged to report and reduce those emissions and then manage the impacts, whether they be carbon emissions or other environmental pollutants.
Which means that the US percentage of this is even a little bit higher than we think. How much, well, first of all, how much of climate damage is militarism, taking everybody's militarism together?
Our estimate, we produced an estimate a few years ago where we estimated the global military carbon footprint was about 5.5% of global emissions. So if it were a country, it would be bigger than the whole of Russia.
So
So that's the kind
significant
of.
to be leaving out of agreements and reports and so.
Yes. I mean, this is the thing. It's kind of a lot of things they go, well, the military supply chains, their industry. So they're being dealt with by industrial policy. But if your spending is saying we must spend on these technologies and we must relax our environmental regulations to make sure we have these technologies, and that's what's happening across the world, then it does undermine your whole environmental strategy.
And so, what percentage of the military environmental or climate increase is from the United States? I mean, with Europe, copying all the mistakes of the United States instead of the United States learning from all the accomplishments of Europe. I used to think I could say that if the United States just got down to European levels of destruction, we'd be good for a while. I don't know if you can say that anymore, but what percentage, if you just fixed this one little country with 4% of humanity, how safe would we be?
It's difficult to say because the uncertainties are large. The data is so poor that the uncertainties around that 5.5% figure are large. I mean, you've got to look at a variety of factors around how many military personnel different countries have, how many high energy consuming vehicles they have, how often they're used. We haven't done the estimate of the proportion of military carbon emissions or the global military carbon footprint by country, and that's some work that needs to be done. There's still a whole debate around, what do you include and how long are the supply chains. It's certainly very large, and the US being the largest military spender and that having the largest air force and having huge supply chains is going to be an outsize proportion of that total.
I'm willing to wager, if you'll take a friendly bet, that over 50% is the United States.
Possibly not that much.
Well, we'll make it
I
a.
think, yeah, I mean, there are other issues. I mean, you've got to bear in mind that countries like China and Russia have much larger numbers of military personnel. They are much more fossil fuel dependent. So, yeah, it then that kind of makes up to some extent the fact that they have smaller air forces and don't use them as much. And they're also a lot of their aircraft and warships and tanks are less energy efficient. And I mean, one of the reasons why, for example, European and American equipment tends weapons platforms tend to be more energy efficient is simply because it can be cheaper, and they have that means that they can have an operational advantage. They can have an advantage on the battlefield, and this is what is driving the technological change in this area. If militaries see an advantage on the battlefield from reducing their carbon emissions, then they will do so. But if they don't, they won't. This is the sad fact of the issue. This is why we have to go bigger and look at, well, we need to do far more about reducing conflict, finding peaceful ways of dealing with difficulties using diplomacy, mediation, and military strategies themselves. At the very least, need to be much more what's defense orientated, not about global power projection.
But of course, NATO and weapons spending enthusiasts will tell you that the bigger the military, the fewer the conflicts. Facts be damned, this is what they'll agree with. Fewer
Yes, I
conflicts.
mean
Well,
the evidence from history does not bear that out.
oh.
It's really much more complicated. It's like, if you have a basic military and you've got aggressive neighbors, then you're probably safer than you have no military at all. But if you are in a more peaceful world with less military spending across the board, then you are in a much better world. And if you engage in arms racing with your neighbors, then everyone loses, and the chances of war breaking out is much higher. Yeah, it's at the very least much more complicated than they claim, and actually, yeah, I mean, if we just looked for more peaceful solutions, much more, we would find them. The old adage, if you want peace, prepare for war, which comes from the Roman Empire, and is repeatedly quoted now. It's no. If you want peace, prepare for peace.
Yes, absolutely. And it didn't work for the Roman Empire either, or for the guy who
No.
said it. So we got just a few minutes left. Stuart Parkinson, what are your recommendations, both to big institutions and governments and to people listening to this program?
I think the first one is a very relatively simple one, is that we need better measurements of military carbon emissions, both direct emissions and supply chain emissions. So that we at least understand better the scale of the problem. But in parallel with that, we need governments to realize that the safety of the world is based on a more peaceful world, and a more peaceful world where militaries are as small as we can get away with, and the direction of travel is to reduce spending and reduce activity. and find diplomatic solutions. We have there was a report today that came out from climate scientists saying we have 3 years left before we use up or we pass the limit for 1.5 degrees temperature rise in global warming, and that puts us into a very dark place in terms of climate system instability. We need to refocus on tackling climate change and broader environmental issues. We can't afford to be distracted by threatening yet another conflict on another group of people.
There are these annual meetings, the COPs, where as far as I can tell, nothing much useful has ever been done. Do people still bother with these? Have a lot of people given up entirely on the United Nations? Is there any point?
Well, I think it's important that we continue to have this dialogue and negotiation and get whatever agreements we can from these meetings. It's the only global forum for doing it. It did give us the Kyoto Protocol in 1997. It gave us the Paris Agreement in 2015. These are guiding, reductions in climate action. But yeah, they're not enough. And we are seeing many more multilateral initiatives sort of agreed on the sidelines of these meetings. So there are alliances to eliminate coal, there are alliances to eliminate oil and gas, there are alliances to agree new treaties on controlling deforestation, for example. So they serve a purpose, they're just not good enough. And we need a few more global leaders to step up and take the initiative and push policies in this area much, much faster.
I'm
And we're
sure you're
not
right about
seeing that
that.
from some Western nations at the moment. They've dropped the baton.
They're moving quickly in the wrong direction. We're just about out of time, Stuart Parkinson. Where and when is the next such meeting?
The next meeting is in Brazil in November, on the edge of the Amazon rainforest. There's kind of the Brazilian government is pushing this as, we really need to get on and agree some proper targets here. And it was billed as after the last couple of meetings have taken place in petro states in Azerbaijan and United Arab Emirates and Egypt before that. We're finally in a country that's taking climate change seriously, but the trouble is that the momentum's being lost with Trump pulling out and with Argentina pulling out as well. It's going to be a struggle, but we have to keep pushing
Well,
all the levers that we have available. We have to keep pushing.
I'm glad to hear it. Stuart Parkinson is Executive Director, Scientists for Global Responsibility. The website is sgr.org.uk. Stuart, thanks for everything you're doing, and thanks for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.